Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Now that they've got the power, what are Republicans in the House going to do with it? What's coming on television later this year, and what is going on with oil prices? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering its Raise Your Rate CD as well as an online savings account and money market account. Learn more at allybank.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday. This one's the 5th of January. Glad you could be with us. As the 112th Congress begins and John Boehner takes over as Speaker of the House, Republicans now have the tricky business of actually delivering on campaign promises. The GOP won in large part by promising to cut spending and get the deficit under control. House Republicans are going to trim their own administrative budget by $35 million. That's millions with an M, so largely symbolic and not much of a dent in a deficit that is more than $1 trillion. That's with a T. But it's a start. Republicans do have much bigger spending targets in mind, though, although the party is getting an early lesson in how difficult actually controlling spending is going to be. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports now from Washington.
Even as he accepted the Speaker's gavel, John Boehner recognized that keeping order in the House of Representatives will be tough.
Our spending has caught up with us, and our debt soon will eclipse the entire size of our national economy.
House Republicans pledged to bring the federal budget down to 2008 levels. But on the rare occasions when they say how they'll do that, even traditional allies have objected. For example, the Republican caucus voted yesterday to make transportation projects subject to cuts. That sparked an immediate reaction from construction and rail industries. Pete Ruane is the president of the American Road and Transportation Builders Association.
Cutting this kind of spending in this environment is against the interests of the business community, is against the interests of economic recovery, and is poor public policy.
Reaching the Republican budget goal would mean cutting spending by $100 billion this fiscal year. And GOP budget staffers are already saying that may be unrealistic because the fiscal year will be 5 months old before they can start cutting. Robert Greenstein at the Center on Budget and Policy Priority says cuts that big would have drastic consequences.
That would be the single deepest year-to-year cut in modern U.S. history. And coming at a time when the economy is as weak as it is now, it would cost hundreds of thousands of jobs and send the unemployment rate back up.
The new House Majority Leader, Eric Cantor, says even defense spending will be subject to scrutiny this year, provoking another Republican support group. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The SEC has started sniffing around that Goldman Sachs Facebook deal. That would be the one that left the social networking site with a paper value of $50 billion the other day. Specifically, the SEC is trying to figure out whether the deal breaks some rules that limit a private company to just 500 shareholders before it has to open its books to regulators. The rule in question is 50 years old, from when companies were smaller and startups didn't have the internet to help them get going. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Being a public company has a lot of advantages. People all over the world can buy your shares, and you can raise billions of dollars. But with those perks come rules. Lots of rules. Larry Harris served on the Securities and Exchange Commission and now teaches at USC's Business School. He says being private also has its advantages.
You don't have to report information about your financials to the same extent that you do for a public company.
And there are costs to all that reporting.
It's expensive, and secondly, it lets your competitors know the state of your business, which Facebook may be very concerned about.
Private companies do have the right to sell stock, but it's restricted to just 500 shareholders. Goldman Sachs and Facebook ginned up a rather elegant solution. Goldman created a kind of trust that invests in Facebook as one investor, and hundreds of Goldman clients can buy into that trust. Suddenly, that one investor is really lots of investors. Eric Talley teaches securities law at UC Berkeley.
The SEC undoubtedly is going to be kicking the tires of this deal, and they're probably going to be doing so for a number of months. And this is in part because they are wary of the possibility that down the road you're going to see many, many more deals who are mimicking this exact structure.
Talley says once Facebook gets its financial ducks in order, there would be big advantages to leaving the private life. He says all of that information public companies have to disclose is catnip for investors and would likely push the price of Facebook shares way up. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The private data company ADP delivered some promising data this morning. ADP processes a whole lot of private company payrolls out there, and so in theory has a good handle on the ups and downs of the American labor market. Anyway, the company said today their best guess for the December unemployment report that we're going to get Friday morning will be about 300,000 new jobs last month. If it happens, that would be a nice gain, but it would be well shy of what's happening down south of the border. 2010 was the best year for jobs that Mexico has had in 14 years, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
Mexicans have reason to be optimistic about their economy. Samuel Freje Rodriguez is an economist with the World Bank.
The average wages have started to grow faster again, and the unemployment rates have leveled off.
Officially, unemployment now stands at around 5%. That sounds pretty good, but it doesn't account for all the people working in Mexico's underground economy. Still, Freje Rodriguez says Mexicans are increasingly moving away from informal jobs and joining the formal economy.
The informal employment rates in Mexico have declined during the last 3-4 quarters.
The recession in the U.S. prompted many migrants to return to Mexico. That may cause more competition for some jobs, but these returning migrants also bring capital to start new businesses or build a house. Mauricio Cardenas is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
The return of Mexican migrants has overall had a positive effect on the Mexican economy.
And with a stronger economy at home, there's less incentive for Mexicans to leave. Dimitri Papadimitriou is president of the Migration Policy Institute.
It's going to make it a bit easier for people to decide to stay home and take their chances.
He says there are big demographic changes going on in Mexico. Women are having fewer kids. So in about 10 years, the number of jobs will match more closely with the number of job seekers, making it less enticing to look for jobs in the U.S. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Today made it 3 wins in a row for the Dow if you happen to be keeping a 2011 score sheet. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The big story at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas this week isn't what new gadget might be the hottest thing going. It's who's not going to show up. Apple CEO Steve Jobs is expected to give the CES a pass when it officially starts tomorrow. But his company and how everybody else wants to sell what Apple made popular are all the rage. We've reached Marketplace's Steve Henn from the trade show floor deep inside the Venetian Hotel out in Vegas to talk things over with us. Hey, Steve.
Hey.
So listen, through the magic of radio, it of course sounds like you're right next door, but do I have it right that we had to get you on a payphone to do this because the wireless systems at the Consumer Electronics Show are completely overwhelmed?
Yeah, that's right. I actually overheard a technician saying, you know, we called Sans IT and they say it's the Venetian's problem, and we called the Venetian IT department and they say it's Sans' problem.
It's nice to know IT guys are the same all the world over, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So what is the big thing that's at the Consumer Electronics Show this year once you guys eventually get into the technology part of this thing?
Well, you know, this is the year of the tablet. Everyone wants to create a tablet that will grab a piece of the business that Apple created with the iPad. So there's something like 80 to 100 new tablets being unveiled here. And the general trend seems to be that people want to build something that's slick but cheaper than the iPad and then grab a piece of the business. Most of the analysts I've talked to about that, though, think that's not going to work, that the iPad will probably remain the dominant tablet next year. You know, if you can buy a $99 tablet but it's a piece of junk, it's really not that cool.
What about stuff like 3D that was hot last year, all of those things from years gone by?
Well, 3D is making a comeback. You know, there's a sequel. But I think one of the most interesting trends right now is that lots of devices that you don't typically think of as computers or cell phones are getting connected to the web. So LG, which makes flat-screen TVs and cell phones, put on a dog and pony show today where they talked a lot about how they wanted to connect your fridge to the web and your washer and dryer to the web. And we've been imagining them since, you know, we were all watching the Jetsons. So pretty soon we're going to be walking through a world where the cell phone in our pocket is talking to things all around us. And I think that is pretty interesting.
Yeah, but Steve, you're right there where everybody believes in all this stuff. What are the odds of any of this stuff getting to the consumer anytime soon?
Well, I think, you know, the fridge that sends you a text when you're running low on milk probably isn't coming this year. But yeah. I do think that, you know, within the next year or two, devices that you never thought would be talking to your cell phone are going to start. And we're already seeing that in things like automobiles and, you know, obviously TVs are wired for the internet now. And so I do think this is coming. But maybe I just, you know, drank the Kool-Aid.
Marketplace's Steve Henn from the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, Nevada. Steve, thanks a lot.
Sure thing.
Running a series of commentaries this week asking the question, what now? What's going to be in the news in 2011 that we're going to have to figure out? We've done healthcare and financial reform, but not everything has to be serious policy wonk stuff. And so in that light, NBC announced not too long ago that this month it's going to be airing half-hour comedies in the 10 p.m. hour on Thursdays. But 10 o'clock is supposed to be for dramas, right? It's the hour of ER and CSI and Law and Order. Commentator and co-creator of the NBC series Parks and Recreation, Michael Shore, says, oh, it's about time for a change.
Television watching has always been about routine. In the old days, we would all gather in front of the TV at a certain time each night, turn to a certain channel, and watch a certain show. Incidentally, by the old days, I mean like 2002. And the traditional Big Four networks had routines of their own. They scheduled game shows at 7, family comedies at 8, edgier comedy or light drama at 9, serious dramas at 10, local news at 11. So why are these routines changing? Because right now, there is too much good TV. Now, some people may scoff at that notion. There is still an odd stigma attached to watching TV, I suppose because it seems unserious or disposable. People don't like to think of themselves as TV watchers. They think of themselves as the kind of people who read thick novels. And when you work in television, people constantly go out of their way to tell you that they hate television. I don't watch anything on TV, they'll say, before rattling off a dozen shows they sometimes catch a little of or watch occasionally. They also tell you how terrible everything is. Why is it all so bad, they'll ask, the implication being it is all your fault. But in reality, everyone watches TV, and for good reason. There are more networks making more high-quality programming than ever before. There are quality shows of every genre, about every subject, on every night. Cop shows, legal shows, medical shows, nature shows. There are like 6 different reality shows about baking cakes. Whatever you're interested in, TV is currently catering to your taste, especially if you like shows about baking cakes. And of course, the more choices there are, the less routine things get. That means it's time to create new routines. Maybe it's comedies at 10. Maybe the network miniseries will make a comeback. Whatever the case, the traditional networks understand that TV watching has fundamentally changed, and they need to change too. But really, what does it matter? I never watch TV anyway. It's all terrible. Except for Parks and Recreation, coming to NBC January 20th at 9:30, which I hear is amazing.
Michael Shore, in case you couldn't have guessed, is the co-creator of Parks and Recreation. Tomorrow, David Frum on what's next in our relationship with China. Until then, we'd love to hear what you are or maybe aren't watching. Visit marketplace.org. Click on that link that says Contact. Coming up, too many jobs, not enough people.
Germany's birth rate is low, 1.4 babies per woman. That means fewer engineers and software developers in the future.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials added 31 points today, a quarter of 1%, ended at 11,722. The NASDAQ up 20 points, three quarters of 1%, 2702 at the bell. The S&P 500 edged up 6 points, about a half percent, closed at 1276. The job survey from ADP that we told you about gave a boost to financial shares. American Express led the way, charged up nearly 3% on this Wednesday. Citigroup deposited 1.4%. Morgan Stanley steamed up 1.25%. The housing sector saw a jump too. KB Home hammered home gains of nearly 4%. Pulte Homes picked up 3.75% today. D.R. Horton tacked on 3.25% as well. Not all good news, though. Shares of Family Dollar deflated 8.75%, that after the discount chain reported earnings that missed expectations. Shares of rival Dollar General dropped 1.4% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.43%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Yellow Book 360, offering a spectrum of marketing tools for small businesses designed to go beyond yellow. More at yellowbook360.com. And by Reputation Defender, protecting online privacy by monitoring the web and removing your personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com. What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Thursday. A look at those holiday retail figures. Chain stores report sales for December. The 12 days of Christmas wind down. Epiphany is celebrated in some regions. And he's got the title role in Mr. Bean and Blackadder. Comedian Rowan Atkinson turns 56. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Crude bounced back over $90 a barrel today, up a buck to $90.30 at the close in New York. Oil prices have been climbing for a good couple of weeks now, driving pump prices up to a national average above $3 for a gallon of gas and leading to some speculation, all right, guesses, that we might see an even bigger bump sometimes later this year. To get a sense of what's really going on, we called the guy who does oil for a living, Tom Closer, the chief oil analyst at the Oil Price Information Service. Tom, good to have you with us.
Hi, nice to be here.
What is it that's driving the price of oil right now? Is it as simple as saying the economy is recovering?
Not as simple as saying the U.S. economy is recovering, probably more worldwide economic growth. And that's been driving the price of crude oil really for the last 6 or 7 months.
I'm hearing people talk about $100 a barrel. We're at 90-something today. How realistic do you think that higher price is?
I think it's realistic, but I don't necessarily think that it'll be a price that we average for 2011. We'll probably have a cup of coffee above that price, and we'll see some prices retrench below that as well. But nothing along the lines of some of the hyperbole you hear out there in terms of $4 or $5 gasoline and $150 crude.
Of course, you know, when it went to 147 a couple of years ago, there weren't too many people saying, oh, yeah, it's going to hit 147.
That's true. But if you were untethered from reality about 2 years ago, you're probably less likely to be untethered from reality within 3 years. And I think that's one thing we have going for us this year.
What about the longer term, though, Tom? It's not like we're going to get off oil in the near-term future.
No, and I'll confine my comments to longer term, meaning this decade. I think at some point this decade, we get into a problem where demand really butts right up against supply. I mean, for the last 6 months or so, worldwide demand is probably more than supply, but there's a huge stock overhang. And that means that at some point this decade, we are going to be dealing with the sort of apocalyptic numbers of maybe $150 crude and $4 or $5 gasoline. I just don't think it's in 2011 or 2012, as some folks have suggested.
What about the counterintuitive argument, though, when you get to oil prices that high, that it's actually a good thing, that it makes us realize that we need alternative technologies and that oil isn't going to last forever?
Well, I think there's some merit to that. The problem with that is that it's a statistical kind of cruelty where people on the margins of society and people who live paycheck to paycheck really get hurt by high prices for gasoline. A lot of people could dismiss even a move to, let's say, $4 this year and say, well, the additional money that a lot of people get in terms of the payroll tax break will pay that off. But that doesn't really help that family of four that's living on a very, very modest scale.
Yeah. You mentioned this at the beginning, the global economy. I have to ask you about China and their influence on oil prices. Rising demand there. They're buying more cars. They're making more stuff.
Yeah. And China is certainly the Michael Jordan, let's say, of the team of emerging economies out there.
LeBron James, man. You've been out of this
maybe
sport
LeBron
for a long time.
James yeah. or the big three there. But they're certainly using a lot of fuel. And the other thing they're doing is they're putting in infrastructure. It's a little bit like building a swimming pool. And initially, you have a real big appetite for the water to fill it up. And that's happening not just in China, but in other parts of the world as well.
Tom Kloza, Chief Oil Analyst at the Oil Price Information Service. Tom, thanks a lot.
Nice to be there. Thanks.
It's Wednesday. Time now for your letters, or emails, actually.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
A couple of weeks ago, we did a story on nonprofit groups sending direct mail solicitations to potential donors, and we wondered along the way if that wasn't a waste of both money and paper. Robert Richardson from Iowa City thought not.
Direct mail industry provides a lot of jobs, mine included, and the use of paper is a renewable resource. The trees used for paper are grown on tree farms, and they're harvested. And while they're growing, they help capture greenhouse gases. In addition, the direct mail industry and bulk mail provide a profit center for the post office.
Also on the program recently, bikes and how New York is introducing European-style bicycle lanes, kind of like in Copenhagen. Michael DeCiano of Brooklyn, New York, in what will probably be this week's most commented upon listener comment, thinks giving those cyclists the run of the road is just a terrible idea.
The very serious issues left unmentioned pertain to lack of enforceable rules for cyclists, lack of insurance for bicycles that involve accidents with pedestrians and cars, and lack of licenses for cyclists who choose to be oblivious to rules of the road and courtesy.
On to something else now, college bookstores and how they're changing. They're selling way more than just course materials now as they try to keep up with the online competition. Suzanne Donnelly helps run the Bronco bookstore at Cal Poly Pomona out here in California. And she says stores like hers just see themselves differently.
So we're having to look at all the rest of our store and say, well, what is it about the rest of this that's really important to students? How does it help create their campus identity? How does it help them feel connected to each other? And we're focusing on what that means a lot more.
Your letters mean a lot to us. They actually do. We read every single one of them. You can click the comment button on our website and also find links to follow us on Facebook and Twitter there as well. It's all on our homepage, marketplace.org. We talked unemployment a little bit up at the top of the program. The December jobs report comes out Friday morning. We should be so lucky, though, as to have Germany's labor problems. While we're trying to figure out how to replace the 8 million jobs we lost in the Great Recession, the Germans are trying to find enough workers for the jobs they have. Kyle James reports now from Berlin.
The phone's been ringing a lot recently at Infopark. The web services company has enjoyed strong growth this year, and it's hiring. There are 10 jobs advertised right now. But founder and marketing director Bernd Fulke says the company's having a hard time finding the people it needs.
We can't fill the open positions that we have quickly. Sometimes it takes months, so we can't grow as fast as we would like to. And in the worst case, it means that we have to turn down work that comes our way.
His company's not alone, not by a long shot. A study by the German Chamber of Commerce found that the country has a shortage of about 400,000 skilled workers. The need is especially acute in engineering, high-tech, and healthcare. Stefan Hadiger heads the labor market department at the Chamber of Commerce.
If you don't have the right people, less is produced, and in the short and long term, that will have a real effect on the country's economic growth.
Germany's birth rate is low, 1.4 babies per woman. That's well under the rate to maintain the current population. That means fewer Germans and fewer engineers and software developers in the future. Back at InfoPark, tech consultant Adam Musiel-Bright explains some of the work he does.
And this system is fully customizable. So it has basic functionality like hold different types of content, like images, like...
He's originally from Poland, and is just what business leaders in Germany need. But it's proving a challenge to import a skilled labor force. Lars Funk of the German Engineering Association points to a recent survey. It found that Germany wasn't all that attractive to top workers from other countries.
We have to change that and get rid of red tape for those who are really going to help our economy. We have to make their start in Germany easier.
That report blamed some of the problem on the German language.
Hallo, ich heiße Emily. Ich komme aus den USA.
It's not an international language like English, and take it from me, not all that easy to learn. The country could also simplify confusing permit rules and recognize more college degrees from overseas. And a recent undertone of anti-immigrant sentiment hasn't helped matters. Labor experts say the country just needs to be more welcoming all around. But some who've come here say Germany's welcomed them just fine. Cabe McCall moved to Leipzig from Santa Barbara 3 months ago to work in neuroscience. Tonight his institute is having a party, and it's full of plenty of imports. He thinks Germany doesn't perform well in surveys because it hasn't sold itself like it should.
My guess would be that that's branding, so that, you know, Germany just probably isn't as chic as whatever else showed up as higher on the list.
So maybe Germany needs something like the UK's Cool Britannia campaign from the 90s, although it's hard to think of what the German equivalent would be.
Germany, now it's funny. Now we have a sense of humor, something like that.
In Berlin, I'm Kyle James for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, kind of an amazing story out of Columbus, Ohio. A photographer for the Columbus Dispatch shot a video the other day of a homeless man asking for spare change on a freeway ramp. Nothing remarkable there except the guy sounds like this.
When you're listening to nothing but the best of oldies, you're listening to Magic 98.9.
That kind of explains the sign the guy was holding. His name is Ted Williams, and the sign said he's a former radio announcer who has the God-given gift of voice. So knowing talent when they hear it, executives at the Cleveland Cavaliers, NFL Films, among others, say they want to talk to Mr. Williams about a job. The video was posted 2 days ago. You can see it on our website, marketplace.org. It's already got 5.5 million hits.
And don't forget, tomorrow morning is your chance to win a pair of tickets to see this man live in concert.
Or, you know, back on the radio, whatever. That's Marketplace from American Public Media on this Wednesday. Today, the Dow added 31 points, about a quarter of 1%. The NASDAQ picked up 20 points, 0.75%. The S&P 500 tacked on 6 points, half of 1%. Bahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time, back on the big show, how do you say I quit in German?
I'm feeling comfortable, earning enough money not to starve. I don't think I will go back to Germany.
A booming Turkish economy and what that means for the Germans. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.